discussion, I want to do a series of, we were talking about the 1920s, so I want to continue, but I want to do a series about Germany and the Jews in Germany, and we'll hopefully be able to see the background for the terrible events that occurred. In 1918, at the end of the First World War, and the First World War is probably the most brutal, dehumanizing war that ever was fought, because it was fought in trenches and casualties were appalling, and the war was pretty static for long periods of time, so people were just getting killed for nothing. Eventually over 8 million soldiers would be killed in the war, and plus another probably 12, 13 million civilians. So you're talking about an enormous bloodbath, which until that time had never yet occurred. Now, Germany attempted to win the war in the spring and summer of 1918. It had made a peace treaty with the Bolshevik government in Russia in 1917. Lenin, in order to buttress the Bolshevik government, gave away enormous areas and resources to the Germans because he wanted to take control in Russia. And he had this secular messianic belief. Secularists also have messianic beliefs, utopian belief, that Marx was right. Eventually we're going to have this great proletariat revolution. It would cover the whole entire world. So he didn't care that Germany would get territory now because of the fact that sooner or later, and he felt sooner, Germany was going to undergo this great proletarian revolution. It would become Bolshevik, and Germany and Russia would be one, so what's the difference? To a great extent, one should never base foreign policy or defense policy on messianic delusions, which unfortunately is common. Now, I think that that's part of what the Rambam means when he says that we should leave the Messiah out of this, that when it happens, we'll know about it, but otherwise, you know, it's not really our place to decide messianic things.
Where is the Rambam?
The Rambam says that in the end of Hilchus Melochim. The Rambam, by the way, has a very bland messianic era. He says that he's of the opinion of Shmuel in the Talmud, that Ein Bein Olam Hazeh L'Mos HaMashiach El Hashibet Malchius Bilvad. That the only difference in the messianic era will be that Condoleezza Rice won't come to visit us. But otherwise, the world will go on as it goes on. So that's hard to sell to the Jewish people today after 2,000 years of exile and blood and everything else. And you tell them, you know, that the end will be that we'll be independent of the nations of the world. So therefore, the Jewish people have raised the stakes. The messianic era is, apples made of gold falling off the tree. And the revival of the dead, everything is lumped into the messianic era. The Rambam specifically separates all of those eras. And he really makes it a very bland messianic era. But again, emotionally it's hard to deal with. People my age go to the doctor and he says, you're okay for a man your age. You don't feel so happy about that, right? You want to be 35. You don't want to be a man your age.
The doctor said you're as old as you feel.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go to that doctor. So Lenin sends two Jews by the name of Yaffe and Trotsky to negotiate this treaty. It's the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with the Germans. The Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, in effect, gives Germany, Lithuania, and Poland. And it gave away 70% of the industrial area of Russia. It was an enormously unfair treaty, but he didn't care because he had to get, you know, for his purposes, it was a good deal. So Germany is now freed from the war on the Eastern Front. So it takes all of the soldiers that it had on the Eastern Front and moves them to the Western Front against Britain and France. And the German General Staff under Generals Ludendorff and Hindenburg prepare this great spring-summer offensive in 1918 to finally end the stalemate on the Western Front and break through and capture Paris. And they almost do it. They break through the Allied lines. And they advance 40 miles when in the previous years they advanced 40 yards. And they're on the verge of success. But then they run out of gas. They run out of steam. They don't have sufficient supplies. The Allied blockade has hurt them greatly. And now there's a million. There are a million American soldiers in France that are thrown into the battle, and they are the they are what tips the balance scale. Fresh troops, well-equipped troops, you know, down to the last chocolate bar. And Americans don't go into the war, without everything being there. And the advent of the Americans ends the German offensive. Americans suffered a great deal of deaths in the First World War comparative to the time that they were in the war. A very high casualty rate. But compared to what Britain suffered, a million dead, France, 2.5 million dead, Germany, 2.5 million dead, Russia, 3.5 million dead, Austria, 1.5 million dead. So when they compare it to those numbers, so America paid a cheap price. Even though if someone was one of the numbers, it wasn't cheap. So by the fall of 1918, Germany, the general staff of the German army is aware that it cannot win the war. And they therefore decide, they force the Kaiser to abdicate, because the Kaiser would be an impediment to any arrangement with the Allies. So he gets trucked off to Holland. And the provisional government is made, and the General Staff enters into an armistice. It's not a peace, it's an armistice. It's not a surrender. And the armistice agreement allows the German army to withdraw to Germany intact, basically with its weapons. And in the war, no Allied soldier ever stepped on German soil. Germany never was, the war was fought on somebody else's soil. Belgium, France, Russia, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but it was never fought on German soil. Now what happens? a peace conference is called at Versailles. In the peace conference at Versailles, very onerous terms are imposed on the Germans. The Allies say that the entire war was the fault of the Germans, and therefore the Germans have to bear the cost of the war. So part of the cost of the war is tremendous reparations. The payment of the reparations would have lasted into the 1980s. So that they have to pay to France and England, the United States. Russia's out of the picture because it became Bolshevik, so they forget it. Germany loses a great deal of territory because new states are carved out of the previous empires. So you had Czechoslovakia to the south, Poland, Lithuania, the Baltic states to the east, and France occupies the Saar basin and also the Rhineland. So Germany loses a lot, a great deal. And all sorts of restrictions are placed on the German army, how many soldiers they're going to have, what weapons they're going to have, etc. The Allies are determined that Germany will not again be the aggressor in Europe. Now, all of this is ludicrous when we look back, because Germany did whatever it wanted to anyway. And everything that they were determined not to happen, happened. But that's the way it looked in 1919. Two other disasters happened to Germany, aside from the defeat. First of all, there's the pandemic of the flu, of influenza throughout the world. It kills almost 20 million people. More people were killed in the flu epidemic than the First World War. More American soldiers died from the flu epidemic than died in the war. So that's tremendous devastation. It's like the Black Death, the Black Plague in Europe in the Middle Ages. And then the Allies, in order to enforce the terms of the treaty and make certain that Germany would comply with it, continued the blockade of Germany so that the German people literally were reduced to starvation. In hindsight, we can see that all of those policies were, to put it mildly, erroneous. After the Second World War, when that'll explain why America had the Marshall Plan and built Germany up again, simply because it didn't want to repeat the mistakes of after the First World War. So Germany now is really at its low point. There arise now in Germany different groups, violent groups. One group is called the Freikorps, the Free Corps. They are a veterans organization, German soldiers who returned from the trenches of the First World War. They are brutalized, the war brutalizes the soldiers, especially the trench war. They have no regard for human life, because they've seen so much death. And they are right-wing nationalists, and they say Germany never lost the war. Not the army's fault. The army never was defeated, because the German general staff, the generals, never explained why they took the armistice. They never said, you know, we were beaten, Germany would have been invaded and destroyed, we couldn't stop the Allies, and they never said that. So there arose this legend that we were stabbed in the back. Somebody, the home front, stabbed us in the back.
Schnellenbruch.
Who are the home front? So the home front are the communists, the Bolsheviks, and the Jews. After a while, the Bolsheviks and the Jews became synonymous. Now, it just so happened that the people who signed the peace treaty for Germany, some of them were Jewish. There was a famous Jewish diplomat, banker, patriotic German, member of the war cabinet. His name was Walter Rathenau. Rathenau signed and they killed him. He was assassinated, as were many other people. It was completely lawless. Now, the other group were the Bolsheviks. The communists were certain that they're going to create this revolution in Germany now, and Germany's going to follow the Soviet Union. And Lenin put a lot of secret agents and money and supplies into Germany to make it happen. And many of the leaders of the communists in Germany were Jews. So there was a communist revolution in Munich that brought to power somebody by the name of Kurt Eisner, who was a Jew. It only lasted a few weeks, and then the German government put it down. In Berlin, there was a Jewish girl by the name of Rosa Luxemburg, called Red Rose, and she led a revolution. In Hungary, there was a revolution that was led by a Jew named Bela Kuhn, which is Cohen. So you had this specter in Europe of communism, Bolshevism, being led by Jews to overthrow the established way of order. All of this is important for us to understand in the background of you know, the basic question is, how could Hitler have done what he could, what he did? So we have to see that the ground is prepared for him. He does not appear in a vacuum. He's not a sudden, you know, epiphany on the road somewhere that all of a sudden, you know, decides. Now, the we have a few ironic things here that go on. It's always ironic. Lenin, for instance, is shot. He's not killed, but he's shot by a Jewish girl, Lifshitz, who, because she felt that Lenin was not Bolshevik enough. Lenin never fully recovers from that. She's put to death, naturally. But that that arouses within the Bolsheviks a suspicion of Jews, which later, in Stalin's time, will develop into open anti-Semitism. So the Jews are the Bolsheviks, so therefore that's why we hate them. And the Jews are not the Bolsheviks, and that's why we hate them. So, I mean, if we look back at the 20th century and see how the Jews survived it, we can only see the hand of God. In the 1920s in the United States, there's a great deal of anti-Semitism, open anti-Semitism. I mean, we think of a world that Lieberman can run for president. I was at a meeting once with Senator Lieberman last year, and he was introduced as the vice president in exile because he won the popular vote, but he didn't win the election. But just to think of it is, you know, it really is astounding. Our grandparents would never believe it, that a Jew, but let alone an observant Jew, and somebody whose wife is named Adassa, and his daughter goes to the Beis Yaakov in Silver Spring, you know, like that's, you know, I saw an interview with him after his mother died, so he's got a beard for Shloshim. You know, like, it's just wild. when Barry Goldwater ran for president in 1964. So Goldwater was a great-great-grandson of a Jew, Goldwasser, that made the famous department stores in Arizona, which was the basis of the family fortune. So Goldwater said ruefully, he's a very clever man, got a bum rap because everything that he said came true. But one of the things that he said is, if I would have known that Johnson was going to keep the war going in Vietnam, I would have voted for him. But he said that it's ironic that the first Jew that be elected that can be elected president is a Presbyterian. But that didn't happen, right? The first Jew that really had a shot at anything was an Orthodox Jew, right? So that's a strange world. But 1920s, that was not the world at all. You had Henry Ford, who was a rabid anti-Semite, and he owned a newspaper called the Dearborn Independent. It was just full of vitriol against the Jews. He lost a libel suit, and his company tried to keep him under wraps because Jews didn't buy Fords. As late as when I was buying cars in America, Jews still had an aversion to buying a Ford. Ku Klux Klan was very powerful. Jews were lynched. All sorts of things. And there was a quota in universities. Only a certain percentage could go to the university and be admitted. Medical schools were very, very difficult for Jews to get into. Really, until the Yeshiva University opened their medical school, the Einstein School, in the 1950s, only then did it start to break down. There was a Jewish medical school in Chicago. Chicago Medical College was founded by Jewish doctors. Jews had to make their own schools. There was a Jewish physicist by the name of Richard Feynman. Feynman was an absolute genius. I read a biography of his called Genius. He was a great, if he would not have lived at the same time as Einstein, he would have been the greatest physicist of the century. But you know, you need mazel when you live. So because he lived in the time of Einstein, so he was not the greatest, just he was great. La'avdol, we can say, the same thing happens in the Jewish world. I mean, if you were a rabbi at the time of the Gaon of Vilna, you weren't going to get anywhere. Where if you're a rabbi, if you would have been born three centuries later, you'd be, you know, who knows what. So there's an element of good fortune in every situation. So in any event, Feynman is somehow admitted to MIT. This is in the 1930s already. He's admitted to MIT, and he's not only the outstanding student, he's like they never saw anybody like him before in his abilities. Feynman wants to go to Princeton, and when he graduates, because Princeton University has a think tank for physicists headed by Einstein. Many of the great physicists of Europe by then had escaped, had left Europe and come to the United States, so Princeton set up a think tank for physicists at Princeton University in New Jersey, and Einstein was the head of it. So Feynman wants to go there. He sends in his application. They reject it because, in the words of the registrar, we have enough Jews here. Feynman doesn't give up. He goes to the president of MIT, and he says, would you please write a letter, intervene on my behalf? So the president of MIT writes a letter to the president of Princeton, and this is pretty much a verbatim quote. He says, even though this applicant is of that peculiar race you should nevertheless consider his application for admission because he is a true genius. And that's how he gets into Princeton. So we cannot imagine Princeton doing that. They can't imagine anybody writing a letter like that. The president of MIT to write a letter that you're that peculiar race. But that's what it was. And so you have an aura of anti-Semitism that envelops the world. It's not localized to Germany. All of the governments, with the exception of Czechoslovakia, but all of the governments of Eastern and Central Europe are openly and bitterly anti-Semitic. The Baltic states, Poland bans, there are all sorts of, the Jews can't keep their stores open on Sunday, all sorts of laws meant to displace the Jewish population. And so in this atmosphere of open anti-Semitism, the legend of the Freikorps, that they were stabbed in the back and that the stabbers were Jews, gains tremendous credibility. The comment of the chief rabbi of Moscow about Trotsky, Trotsky's real name was Bronstein. So he said, Trotsky makes the revolution and Bronstein pays the bill. Which means that there are individual Jews who are radicals who do all sorts of things, but the Jewish people have to pay the bill. We pay the bill for their excesses. There's a Austrian by the name of Adolf Hitler. Hitler is born in Linz in Austria. He is a terrible student. Can't find his way in life, can't make a living. He has bohemian working habits. He sleeps for 2 days. He could be in the yeshivas. And he's an amateur painter. He thinks he's Rembrandt. But his paintings are kitsch at best. And he, by the time he's 14, 15, is a rabid anti-Semite. We have no idea where it came from in his book, Mein Kampf, which I'm going to discuss. He describes that the first time he saw, an Eastern European Jew in Austria with the beard and the whole thing. So he said that an alien from another planet that doesn't deserve to be on Earth. Now, in 1914, when the war breaks out, he's drafted for the Austrian army. But the Austrian army rejects him because of his physical condition. He was frail. And because they said, quote, emotional instability, which translates into the Yiddish word meshuga. But Hitler is determined to go to war. There's a picture of him. I have it in my documentary. In the midst of a tremendous crowd of people cheering, when the First World War broke out, everybody cheered. In London, in Paris, in Vienna, in Berlin, in Moscow, it was in St. Petersburg. You ask why? No, because people are nuts, that's why. So there's a picture of him in the middle of the mob, and his face is beaming like there's a light inside of it at the outbreak of the war, because the war is going to give him something to do. It's going to raise him from his anonymity. So he's rejected for the Austrian army. He goes to Bavaria in Germany, and there somehow he is accepted in the Bavarian army, which was under the command of the German army, the general German army. Now, in the First World War, there were jobs that were suicidal. The First World War had barbed wire. All the fields were laid with barbed wire. So they had to have a guy to go lie down on the wire so that the other guys could step on him and get across it. But those guys never lasted more than 10 minutes. One of the suicidal jobs was being a dispatch runner. They did not have community. They didn't have cell phones or anything. Couldn't call up, no walkie-talkies. So you had to, so let's say you were, the commander was at the 500 meters away from a certain group of soldiers. He wanted those group of soldiers at 5 o'clock in the morning to start, shooting in this direction. How did he tell them? So we had dispatch runners that ran. Then now, in order to run, you had to run outside the trench. You couldn't run in the trench. So these guys also didn't last too long because they were, on each side, there were sharpshooters whose sole task was to pick off the runners. Because if you picked off the runner, you disrupted the communication. Hitler was a runner for 4 years. It gave him a feeling that he was untouchable. Nothing could stop him. And he always said that the Lord preserved him for a special mission. Now, I can't speak for the Lord, but there's no question that, there's something here. Because almost nobody survived being a runner. And he was able to survive it. 2 weeks before the war ended, there was a gas attack on the German lines. The First World War, part of the horrors of the First World War was the use of poison gas, which if a person did not have one's gas mask fixed, caused people to die horrible death because the phosphorine gas invaded the lungs. It was a terrible thing. It also caused blindness. So Hitler was blinded by the gas attack. He was taken out of the lines. This is 2 weeks before the armistice, and he's put in the military hospital. Hitler is blind for 18 months. He stays in the hospital. He's unaware that the armistice even occurred. He doesn't know what happened with the war. When he emerges from, and now he's regained his eyesight, and he hears that the armistice was signed, and that there are French troops on the Rhine, and that everything that Germany gained in the East was taken away from them, he's a raging bull. And he says that everyone that had anything to do with that is going to be killed, is doomed. He's going to take care of him, which he did. Now, this this German government, it's called the Weimar Republic, after the city of Weimar, which was a university town in Germany, where the original constitution was drawn up, etc. The Weimar Republic was controlled by two or three centrist parties, Social Democratic Party, the Catholic Alliance. It was liberal, it was democratic, but it was German. And at the two extremes, you had the Freikorps or the Volkische parties on one side, the right, and the other extreme, you had the Bolsheviks, the communists on the left. Each of them wanted to topple the Weimar Republic so that they would, in a strange way, join forces to do it, because each one hated the democratic society more than anything else, because each one felt that the Democratic Society would be the one that would not allow them to come to power. So, the Weimar Republic then did a few things. First of all, secretly, it made a deal with Lenin and with Stalin in Russia, and the Russians trained the German army. The German army couldn't be, they weren't allowed to have anything. But the Russians built tanks, the Germans gave them the plans and they built the tanks. They built airplanes for them. They trained them in warfare, all of which would come back to haunt Russia. But that's how Germany was going to get around the restrictions, the military restrictions placed upon it. The second thing that happened was, how are you going to pay off all of these billions of reparations? So the peace treaty allowed it to be paid off in Reichsmarks, in the German coin, German currency. So what they did is they purposely debased the German currency. And I say you had to pay a billion marks. So a billion marks could have one time been worth, let's say, $1 million. But when you print a billion marks and just throw it out there, so then a billion marks is worth 10 cents. There are pictures of people going shopping in Germany with wheelbarrows full of money. They couldn't get a denomination large enough. They printed their bills in billions and trillions. Now, what that did is it really, knocked the reparations down. But what it did is it destroyed the German middle class. It destroyed people who had a pension, who had a fixed income. It destroyed the stock market. It destroyed everything. And this created another large class of very dissatisfied people who hated the Weimar Republic. So you have the left that hates it. You have the right that hates it, and then you have the middle class that to a great extent has been brought to poverty because of the government and its policies. So the Weimar Republic is unstable. It was never popular. Then you have another thing that occurs. You have the Weimar Republic is extremely liberal. So homosexuality is legalized. All the sexual taboos are destroyed. Everything goes. Anything goes. And Germany was known then in the 1920s as the loosest country in the world. And a lot of it, the Jews had a hand in it. You know, when Jews are holy, there's no one holier. And when they're unholy, there's nobody unholier. So there were vast rings of prostitution. There were tens of thousands of prostitutes in Berlin. The theater, I mean, risque was not the word. I mean, everything went. Nightclubs, tire breakdown, and the German population receded, became smaller. Less people married, less people have children, and those who had children had less children. And because of the losses of the First World War and the flu epidemic, so you had a problem. Now, you have the same problem in Europe today, except today the problem was allegedly solved by bringing in people from Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. But now it seems that that was not such a good idea. But Europe is shrinking, demographically shrinking. And country that shrinks is in great great danger, its economy and everything else. So when the Nazis come to power, one of their main thrusts is to have more children. They pay to have more children, which in an ironic way happened here in Israel also. The reason that there were kitzbaot liyeladim, that they the welfare, you know, if they pay you money after the third child or whatever, and then they pay more money after the sixth child, whatever, you know, so people made a living having children, was in order to increase the population. But that also boomeranged, because the only ones that really took advantage of it were the Arabs and the Haredim, both of which are not popular groups amongst the governing elite. So that's why it changed now. They're cutting it out under all the economic reforms, because they want that rate of growth to drop, and it will drop. Hitler looks for a political base, political party. So in 1920, people of the Freikorps establish a party under General Ludendorff. Ludendorff is one of the heroes, German heroes of the First World War. But Ludendorff is not an adept politician at all. So there's a little party. It's called the National Socialist Republican Party. So would that cover
German Workers' Party.
Right, and German Workers' Party. So it includes everybody, right? He's got one in the name, whatever you're for, they're for it. And the acronym of the party in German is Nazi. Hitler had membership card number 7. The guy that was number 1, Strasser, Hitler pushes him out of the way very shortly, because Hitler discovers that he has great powers of oratory. Now, we live in a world where oratory practically doesn't exist, and where it does exist, it doesn't count. You cannot imagine that you're going to go hear a speech of 2.5 to 3 hours from anybody. I know rabbis who have it written in their contract that they can only speak 10 minutes. I was invited to be a scholar in residence in a synagogue here in Israel in Rehovot, and the president of the synagogue called me up and he said, I have to inform you of 2 things. He said, first of all, you have to speak in Hebrew, and secondly, you can speak no longer than 10 minutes. So I told him both things are one, because my Hebrew only lasts 10 minutes, so you shouldn't have to worry about it. But you know, in the good old days, I mean, nobody got going for the first 20 minutes, right? It was just, Hitler spoke 2.5 to 3 hours. And 2.5 to 3 hours, he mesmerized. He had a tremendous power to mesmerize crowds, to mesmerize people. It was almost hypnotic. And he discovered that quality within himself. When he discovered that quality within himself, he toured all the beer halls, because that's where the action was. And he got up and made these impromptu speeches, and the party began to grow. In 1923, Hitler overreached himself. He thought that he was so powerful already that he attempted to make a revolution, a putsch, in Munich to take over the Bavarian government. And from Bavaria, he was going to take over the rest of Germany. General Ludendorff, he co-opted him into the Nazi party. Ludendorff accompanied him. They marched through the streets of Munich, and the German police shot and put it down. 11 Nazis were killed. Hitler was arrested. And but the trial of Hitler, I mean, this was a trial for treason. You lead a revolution against the state. But in the climate of the 1920s, and the fact that everybody, and not everybody, but a lot of people were against the government. So even in the judiciary, there were people that were against the government. Even in the prosecuting staff, there were people that were against the government. Especially the people whose salaries had been diminished to nothing because of the hyperinflation. And therefore, Hitler was found guilty, but he was sentenced very lightly. He got a 6-year sentence. And instead of being placed in a harsh prison, he was like in a in an old age home type of situation. Basically, he was under house arrest. He could have visitors. He ran the party from his prison, so to speak. And he only served 3 years. The parole board released him after 3 years. And in that time, he wrote a book. The book is called Mein Kampf, which in German means my struggle. And it's a rambling, I mean, the book is written by a maniac, right? You can see it. Lunatic. But the book became a tremendous bestseller. Hitler became a millionaire from the book. That's what financed him all the time. He was very, very wealthy. And what makes it very ironic today, the book is still in print. It still sells thousands and thousands of copies all over the world, been translated into every language, and there are numerous lawsuits as to who's entitled to the royalties. So they're, you know, long-lost cousins of Hitler who say that, you know, they're entitled, the German government says they're entitled. The publishers, meanwhile, don't pay anybody, which is always a good policy. And this book is frightening because everything that he said in the book that he was going to do, he did. The book told you exactly what it was going to happen. That he was going to destroy the Jews, he was going to destroy the communists, the Soviet Union, he was going to wipe Poland off the map, he was going to make the British Empire crawl to its knees, give up all its colonies. Everything that he did is in the book, including the fact that he was going to kill out all the Jews. So nobody took the book seriously, the rantings of a madman. That's what makes really the book so frightening, is that in a very short period of time, rantings of the of a madman became the public policy of the largest and most powerful country in Europe. Everybody said, oh, if he gets the power, he'll modify, you know, everybody moves to the center. All of the cliches regarding politicians. Well, it may be regarding politicians, but ideologues is a different matter completely. You know, that people with messianic views of themselves, and that's, they're not given to rational behavior or rational thought. So there begins this tremendous campaign of anti-Semitism in Germany. The Jews get beaten up on the streets. They didn't have to wait till the Nazis came. Hitler organized from the Free Corps a paramilitary organization called the Brown Shirts, the SA. He'll destroy it in the 1930s, kill them all out. But now he could use them. And they were gangs, you know. They would come into a Jewish home, smash all the windows, beat up the Jews there. The police were powerless to stop them. Every night on the streets of Germany, you had pitched battles between the communists and between the Nazis. Now, the Germans can stomach a lot, but they cannot stomach the fact that there's no law and order, that things are not in the proper place, that there's fighting on the streets. And therefore, Hitler's promise that he would restore, and the Weimar Republic government was unable to cope with it, because it meant the civil war. I mean, if you'll think about it, it's a little like our cousins today, the Palestinians, right? You got 10 different armed groups with weapons who fight with each other, who kill each other, who steal from each other. Like all of the settlements in the Gaza Strip were taken over by hooligans, by gangs. The Palestinian Authority, they haven't got one, you know, not one blade of grass, nothing. So the only way to do it is to have a civil war. You don't want to have a civil war, then you can't do anything. The Weimar Republic was not interested in the civil war. So Jews were under great pressure. On the other hand, inside the Weimar Republic, in the judiciary, in the arts, in politics, the Jews rose to very high positions. Probably the Jews had a greater presence in the Weimar Republic than they ever had in any other country in Europe in its history. And the same thing in the academic field, in the universities, in the concert hall, in the museums, wherever you went, there were Jews. Now, Jews were a very, very small percentage of the German population, about 300,000 Jews, 50 million Germans.
Half a million Jews.
What?
Half a million Jews.
No, real German Jews. The other ones are Ostjuden, who we're going to talk about. Talking about German Jews. There were a lot of Jews that did not have German citizenship, German nationality, who came from Poland and who were there, but they weren't part of German society. They never went anywhere. These Jews, I mean, this was, they were the elite. They were the finance and everything. So because of their disproportionate representation, the German people had the idea that there must be 50 million Jews in Germany, much as exists in the United States today. Nobody would believe that, you can't get a minion from Minchem Arev. Nobody around. So, but for all the noise that you make, so then it's got to be, right? You're 10% of the Senate and 10% of the House and two Supreme Court justices and whatever, wherever you turn, you're Hollywood, you're Las Vegas, you're the New York Times, whatever you touch, television. Now you're the NBA, you're the NFL, now you're getting to be Major League Baseball. So there's nothing left for them. You took it all away from them. So when the White Sox won the World Series, and the White Sox are owned by a consortium of New York Jews, Jerry Reinsdorf and Eddie Einhorn, very recognizable Jews. So I saw that one of the columnists wrote, he said the White Sox were originally the team of the Comiskey family. They owned the team for like 70 years. 75 years, and they weren't zoche to really have good teams. He said, poor Comiskey, right? He had to wait for a bunch of New York Jews to come to win the World Series. So there's an irony to that, right? There's a biting edge to that. Like, it's almost sacrilege. So that's what Germany looked like. And again, because of the strong presence of the Jews and the communists and the left, so you have a ready-made mix and you'll add to it the anti-Semitism of the German churches, which had existed for centuries. So it was going to be a very rough ride, if anything happened. But no one figured anything's going to happen. And the last point was that, as I mentioned, there were Ostjuden, who were Jews who came from Poland, who came from the East. The Jews who came from the East didn't look German, didn't speak German, didn't behave German. So much so that their fellow Jews in Germany resented them, because they felt that they were an embarrassment to them. And this Jew from the East, with the the funny hat and the earlocks and the beard and the long nose, became the stereotype caricature of Jews in all of German media. And they were seen as an invasion of aliens, of foreigners, people who had no right to be on German soil. So they were not even called Jews, they were called an Asiatic invasion. Because they came, allegedly they were from Asia. So this is the mix into which we'll see next time that Hitler is able to jump into and exploit for his murderous purposes. Be good, guys.